Ladies and gentlemen, I propose to start off by giving you an account of the field studies that have been undertaken on this project, and then go on to give you a brief rundown on the engineering design aspects of it, and finally to show you some slides which I'm sure you've all seen before. The first study of a pipeline route across Alaska was carried out in 1964. It was based on concepts which have changed for our present project, but it anticipated certain of the principal problems which still apply. Firstly, the presence of continuous or discontinuous permafrost over almost the entire distance. The severe climatic conditions, with temperatures varying, particularly in the interior of Alaska, between minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit in the winter to plus 90 or above in the summer. Also, the logistical problems of material transportation and provision of adequate camp facilities for the construction crews. And finally, the sheer organizational problems of ensuring speedy execution of this project to the highest attainable standards of material and workmanship over nearly 800 miles of extremely difficult country under the most adverse conditions. The next study was commenced last summer in 1968. After the discovery at Prudhoe, and the work was initiated by the Atlantic Pipeline Company and Humboldt Pipeline Company. Their personnel arrived in Alaska in the latter part of July, and they were joined by personnel from pipeline technologists who were acting as our consultants. And they commenced with map studies and aerial reconnaissance over a number of possible pipeline routes. At the same time, other groups, specialists in marine engineering and also ship's captains, were studying the possible locations for a terminal at the southern end of the pipeline. They looked at locations around the west coast of Alaska and along the south central coast, and finally concluded that the most suitable port was at Valdez, which presented the necessary qualities of deep, sheltered, ice-free tidewater with sufficient room for maneuvering very large ships. It also presented us with a pipeline route of the shortest length from Prudhoe Bay. The next job was to reconnoiter the route from Prudhoe Bay down to Valdez. Five survey teams were fielded, one of them working from Prudhoe Bay down through Anaktuvuk Pass, a second one working from Anaktuvuk Pass to the Yukon, the next one from the Yukon down to Fairbanks, the fourth party from Fairbanks to Valdez, and we also had the fifth party doing marine surveys off the proposed dock locations at Valdez. Parties 1 and 2, the northern parties, also examined an alternate route along the Sagavanirktok River, southwards from Prudhoe Bay, crossing over a high unnamed pass over the Brooks Range, following down into the Dietrich River Valley, and joining the Anaktuvuk route at a point just south of Bettles. This route presents more severe hydraulic conditions, as it has a maximum altitude of 4,700 feet, compared with 2,400 feet at the Anaktuvuk Pass. On the other hand, it presents us with the opportunity of following the gravel floodplains of the Sagavanirktok River, and thus avoiding the high ice content problems which we would encounter had we gone directly from Prudhoe Bay diagonally across the Arctic Plain and the North Slope through Anaktuvuk Pass. These field surveys were completed by the middle of September 1969, and the early part of the winter was then devoted to analysis of the findings, cost estimates, which led to the presentation of a report to the three parent companies, as British Petroleum had joined the original two. But we had not at this time made any definite decision on whether to adopt the Anaktuvuk route or the High Pass route. The three companies set up a project organization designated the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. This is a project, not a corporation, and it is charged with the task of engineering design and construction management of the pipeline, the pump stations, the dock at Valdez, and other facilities. The project is based at Houston in Texas, and we have site offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and it is staffed, the project is staffed by personnel from the three owner companies and from pipeline technologists and others. During the winter last year, the Arctic Environmental Engineering Laboratory were consulted on the possibility of installing a test pipeline project on the North Slope. The proposal involved the installation of a test section of 40-inch diameter pipe, 1,000 feet in length, partly buried at varying depths, partly above ground covered with varying depths of gravel. It also incorporates horizontal sag and overbends. The test pipeline was constructed near Barrow with the cooperation of the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory. The entire installation is fully instrumented to determine the effect of locking a pipeline in ice. It contains no oil, and it doesn't have any facility for heating. However, it will give us valuable information on what will happen to the pipeline in the period, which may in some cases be as much as 18 months or even longer, that a pipeline having been laid below ground in permafrost, how it will withstand the ice forces imposed on it. We also had other test sections of smaller diameter pipe laid across ice wedges with different types of bond between the ice and the pipes to determine the effect of the ice wedge cracking, to see whether it would impose any intolerable stresses in the pipe. Another test section was devoted to means of mechanical restoration of tundra, such as using sawdust, foamed insulating material, thicknesses of stripped tundra repiled over the area, And one section was left completely exposed to see what would happen. All these test projects were fitted with thermocouples and, where appropriate, with strain gauges. And the results are being continuously monitored. During February of this year, we fielded a further group of survey parties, which were referred to earlier by Dr. Payton. These teams, equipped with track-mounted boring equipment, and they covered the pipeline route from Livengood northwards across the Yukon. We bored into the Yukon bed through the ice, and from the north banks of the Yukon up to join the winter road, up through Anaktuvuk Pass to Prudhoe, and other parties starting in the divide of the Brooks Range worked southwards down the Dietrich Valley and northwards along the Attigan and the Sagavanirktok rivers. These boreholes varied in depth between 12 to 40 feet, and the locations were selected from existing high altitude aerial photography. They were selected so that they were on points of geological significance rather than on the pipeline route itself, so that by correlation with aerial photographs we could form a composite map of the surface geology of both the Anaktuvuk route and the High Pass route. Samples were taken from the boreholes, transported back to laboratories in Fairbanks, where they were analyzed for moisture content, grading, and so forth. Went through a full series of engineering tests. Subsequent intensive evaluation demonstrated that, in fact, the Sagavanirktok High Pass route is the most suitable for the pipeline. And it provides gravel deposits over most of its length into which the line can be buried without excessive settlement when the hot oil flows through and the frozen ground thaws out. The ice-rich permafrost has not altogether been avoided on the northern end. And at the moment, we expect something like 40 to 50 miles would be constructed above ground. We have also undertaken a comprehensive aerial photogrammetric survey of the selected route. We're using existing low-altitude photography along the southern section from Valdez to the Yukon. We compiled a strip map, a mosaic, on which, using geological information that was already available to us, partly from our own researches and partly from those done by others, particularly the Highway Department, we were able to spot a route on these maps from Valdez to the Yukon. We are also carrying out low altitude photography along the northern section from the Yukon to implement the existing high altitude photography which had been carried out previously. Ultimately, we would have a complete set of maps to a scale 1 inch to 1,000 feet over the entire route, which would comprise our construction drawings. The final routing locations were made, as I indicated earlier, from the characteristics of the soil, types of terrain, and also from a consideration of appropriate construction methods, and mainly considering the direct burial or above ground construction on piles. The manuscript, after it is completed, is digitized for computer analysis, and the printout of the analysis gives us the control coordinates of intersection points all the way along the route. This then gives us a finished construction alignment drawing with a minimum of effort expended on field surveys. A further project that we are experimenting with, I haven't yet heard the results, is on remote sensing. And we are doing this work over a 5-mile length in Goldstream Creek, just north of Fairbanks, using terrain probe radar, which would give us an indication of geological peculiarities which are not evident from the surface. We're also using thermal imagery, which we hope would give us an indication of buried ice masses which are not apparent from the surface. And this is also combined with MS ectochrome photography, which, with ground truth data, will give us, hopefully, a very much better indication of what lies beneath the ground than we can find either by ground inspection or by continuous drilling of boreholes. Other field studies that we've either completed or have underway at the moment comprise a ditching equipment test, which was carried out in Fairbanks here. One site comprised frozen silt. Second site was on frozen gravel. And we used two conventional pipeline ditching machines and one unconventional special. And we found that this special machine, with an extremely heavy wheel, was capable of excavating the ditch. We were working on a 5-foot wide ditch, 7 feet deep, at a fairly good rate, something like a mile a day, through frozen silt with ice inclusions and ice lenses and ice wedges. The conventional type of machines had considerable difficulty in getting through this material. We had a lot of trouble with tooth wear, and we had to use specially treated teeth. On the frozen gravels, however, the ditching machines and even the special one couldn't make very much impression. It was like trying to excavate concrete with a teaspoon almost. And we had to resort to explosives. And we found that not a very high amount of explosive was required to shatter the frozen gravel, which could then be readily excavated by a backhoe. A further study, which is being performed now by the Institute of Arctic Biology in the university here, is a tundra and taiga revegetation project. This comprises the establishment of test plots in sample environments at Wiseman, Anaktuvuk, Sagwan, Prudhoe, and at other locations south of Bettles. Previously disturbed areas were examined to determine which plant species were the first to recolonize damaged tundra and in which order successive colonizations ensued. Also, selected seeds have been planted, and tests are being carried out with different types of fertilizer. These tests also will be continued under greenhouse conditions during the winter. A marine environmental study is being carried out in Valdez Harbour by the Institute of Marine Science and the Institute of Water Resources, both of the university here. And this study includes chemical, physical, and biological aspects of marine environment, together with an examination of the freshwater input and existing effluent input into the harbour. This study will be used as a baseline for evaluation of any environmental change which may take place in the harbour as a result of our construction and future operation. There has been a very preliminary ecological survey carried out from Livengood northwards through the high pass to Sagwan. Sample habitats were selected, and plant, animal, and fish species were catalogued as a first step in establishing the nature of the ecosystems that prevail in the different zones of the northern sections of the pipeline. Engineering field studies have been going on continuously from the early part of this year. And these are aimed at continual refinement of the route, hydrologic studies at rivers, monitoring ground temperatures along the pipeline route, gathering data on seismic areas, investigations into onshore and offshore geology to establish foundation design criteria at the terminal at Valdez, selection of pumping station locations, and in the last month, survey and designs, the first section of our haul road, which is presently under construction between Livengood and the Yukon, which will give us a springboard in which to work up northwards. Turning now to aspects of the engineering design, and a brief description of the route. We're starting at Prudhoe Bay and cross, at the latest count, about 773 miles of route to Prudhoe Bay, to Valdez. Starting at Prudhoe, we have about 100 miles crossing the Arctic Plain and the northern foothills, the North Slope, following the Sagavanirktok River. 100 miles across the Brooks Range, through the valleys on both sides and over the pass, reaching, as I said, an altitude of 4,700 feet. Followed by 350 miles across central Alaska, some of it hilly, some of it flat. Another 100 miles in the mountainous country of the Alaska Range, where we reach an altitude of 3,500 feet at Isabel Pass. Then crossing the Copper River Basin and into the Chugach Mountains, where at Thompson Pass we reach an altitude of 2,300 feet before descending down alongside the Keystone Canyon into Valdez. From the construction point of view, and particularly considering the rock aspect of it, this last section across Thompson Pass and down into Valdez certainly presents one of the quite the most difficult parts of the entire route. The pipe is 48 inch in diameter, and it is in wall thicknesses of 0.462 inches and 0.562 inches. And each of these thicknesses are provided in grades of X60 or X65. And this gives us four different types of pipe. and the choice will depend on the hydraulic gradients and pressures that will be encountered during the operation. The pipe is fabricated to extremely rigorous specifications. One of the factors, for example, which has to be taken into consideration is that the pipe must remain weldable and reasonably ductile at extremely low temperatures, since we anticipate having to work during the winter on many sections of the line. This condition is done by an adjustment, suitable adjustment of the chemistry and also the physical treatment of the metal during its manufacture, so that it is sufficiently ductile at low temperatures, and of course when the line becomes hot with the flow of oil, its full ductility is then restored. Initially, we propose 5 pumping stations, and of course, ultimately there will be 12, so that we have to select sites for all 12 stations before we can start in to build our first 5. The initial capacity of the line is 500,000 barrels a day. And with our 12 pump stations, we will achieve a final capacity of 2 million barrels. The mainline pumping equipment is two-stage centrifugal pumps driven by 13,500 horsepower gas turbines. These gas turbines will be installed in pairs at each pumping station, one operating, one standby. The maximum operating pressure of the line would be in the order of 1,000 pounds a square inch. The tanker loading terminal at Valdez initially will comprise 11 storage tanks of 250 feet diameter, 48 feet high, each with a capacity of 430,000 barrels. We propose initially 3 tanker loading berths suitable to receive ships of up to 250,000 tons. We would also install deballast water treating facilities to treat and the ballast from the ships, and also any drainage down from the tankage areas which may have become oily, together of course with the necessary piping and utilities, power, firefighting water, and this type of thing. The pipeline system and the loading terminal will be operated from a central remote control centre, probably located at the Valdez terminal. The control centre is equipped to monitor and control all the operations throughout the line by a microwave system. Line pressures and volumes will be measured automatically and recorded on the consoles. But at the same time, we would have personnel resident at each of the pump stations to oversee and to maintain the operation of the equipment. The hydraulic calculations of the system are very complicated due to the oil temperature variation along the line. In a 48-inch diameter line, the friction heating is a significant factor, and our calculations have demonstrated that above certain flow rates, the oil actually heats up as it flows down the pipeline. This type of heating effect is not unknown in large pipelines. In order to calculate the hydraulics and the thermal characteristics, it has been necessary to develop special computer techniques and programs for this work. And the hydraulics are further complicated by the non-Newtonian flow, which is encountered at low flow rates or at low temperatures. Fuel supply for the pumping stations at the origin, at Prudhoe, would be gas straight from the field. But at each of the other initial booster stations, we propose to construct skid-mounted topping plants which would produce a kerosene jet type of fuel. The higher fractions and lower fractions would be re-injected back into the pipeline. I've mentioned something on the communications. We have still to make the final decision on whether this will be a microwave system or possibly a buried cable. But whichever we choose, the choice will be done so in order to achieve the maximum reliability possible, so that we have continuous control over the entire system. I would like now to show some slides of the pipeline route. This one indicates the route of the two alternates in the north that were considered and put in place through Anatruden Pass, down past Beppels, and the alternate over the High Pass, rejoining the Anatruden route, and following across the Yukon near Sitas Island, down to the northeast of Fairbanks, following in the foothills to the east of Yardson Air Force Base, and then joining the Richardson Highway through the Alaska Range, over the Copper River Basin, through the Chugach Range to the Valdez Terminal. This is a type of photograph we have seen before, I'm sure. In fact, Dr. Pateman showed you a similar one, showing the polygonal ground encountered on the Arctic Plain area. And here is a photograph taken in one of our test excavations, showing an ice wedge in profile. In this sort of ground, the pipe would be constructed on piles. Here we have the Sagamon Oaktop River traversing the Arctic Plain north of the Brooks Range. And here is a closer up view showing the braided channel features of the river, and showing also the extensive gravel deposits, not only across the river channel, but these extend for a considerable distance on either side of the river through the floodplains. Here we're entering the northern foothills of the Brooks Range and getting closer. This is taken in the Attigan River Valley with the divide on the skyline in the background. And this is the high pass on the Dietrich route, and this is the highest point of the whole line. These photographs were taken during last winter in our winter surveys. Coming down on the southern foothills of the ranges, here we see the Dietrich Valley looking northwards towards the divide. And further south again, the Yukon Crossing. Let me get it sharpened there. This was taken when we were doing our investigations across the riverbed. This line was an ice bridge that we constructed for our brewery to work on, and this was a supply runway on the river ice. The photograph is taken looking upstream. Stevens Village would be over the horizon at the top of the picture. Sighters Island is downstream and off the bottom of the picture. This is another view of the Yukon, looking this time downstream, and the pipeline crossing goes across to this little island in that direction. This is north, south down here, Rampart is way downstream, Stevens Village upstream towards the right hand side of the picture. This photograph is taken in the Alaska Range and approaching Isabel Pass through the Delta River going down here, the Richardson Highway following beside the river. This one further south, looking over the Copper River Basin towards the Chugach Ranges in the background. And here again, you see the Richardson Highway. This is in the vicinity of Hogan's Hill near Sourdough. And here we have Thompson Pass, taken in the winter, the Richardson Highway. And following downhill, we have the Keystone Canyon, the highway beside the river, and our pipeline presently being routed over the shoulder above the highway. And this view is taken at the in the vicinity of the terminal site of Valdez. This is Fort Liskum, Jackson Point, and Old Valdez over at the top there, and Newtown opposite on this side. This sketch indicates a typical booster station, the pipeline at the top, the pump building housing also the drivers, below that, the topping plant, storage tanks. The large one would be used as a surge and relief tank for the line. The smaller ones to store refined fuel. We have station housing and a bunkhouse for permanent and transient personnel. A microwave tower for the communication system. And in the case of the more remote pump stations, we would have to construct airstrips capable of handling the large freight aircraft for transporting in the equipment in the first place and for replacing spare equipment during operation. This one indicates how we would cross the Yukon River. During our boring, we found bedrock level about 25 feet down beneath the bed of the river. And above the bedrock is gravel. And we propose to lay the pipeline in the bedrock 10 feet below the surface of the rock so that it would be secure against any displacement by scour, which may be caused by ice jam formation. The water, as you see, the width of the river there is 2,300 feet. This varies with the depth of flow. Last August, we measured it at 35 feet deep. During the winter, when we were drilling, the depth was down to 12 feet. Below, that's the maximum depth, below 3 feet of ice. This is an artist's sketch which gives an idea of how we would construct the line across the ice-rich permafrost area. We would have to build a gravel construction pad alongside the road, construction surface, using the techniques which have been described earlier this morning and this afternoon, with the appropriate thickness of gravel. And then working off these, we would drive piles set in pairs, the cross piece, and then finally the pipe set in a ring, which would restrain lateral and vertical movement of the pipe. And at every 5,000 feet, we would set anchors to hold the expansion forces that we expect. These anchors would be set on with piles, breaking piles. This indicates the monster ditching machine that was successful on the test ditching site. It's constructed of a Caterpillar D8 tractor on the front end, stretched with the engine out front. To balance the weight of this wheel, which in itself is as heavy as the entire machine that's used in normal pipeline operations in the lower 48. And the need for this weight is just to hold the machine down while it cuts into the ice and through the frozen ground. And that concludes my brief talk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. The next paper is a paper on marine transport and the Northwest Passage Project. Now, this is an excellent example of how you can perhaps control where a laboratory experiment is going to be, but not when it's going to be. Mr. Stanley Haas, who is the project manager for Arctic Marine Task Force Humble Oil and Refining, was going to present this paper, but as you're probably aware, the tanker Manhattan had several delays, and of course, with the science conference coming up, and Mr. Haas is having a paper to deliver here, finally got the tanker off the ground. And they have left, and Mr. Haas is on the tanker. Here, however, to give Mr. Haas's paper is Mr. James Galloway. Mr. Galloway is Vice President and Director of Humble Oil Refining Company. Mr. Galloway joined Humble quite a while ago in 1930 as a petroleum engineer. He was a director of Humble Oil Company, and this is in 1954. He became Assistant Manager of Production Department in Houston and became a director in 58. Later, when Humble merged with some other companies, Mr. Galloway became general manager of the central region and director of the merged company, and was elected to the company's board of directors in 1963. He became vice president of Humble Oil and Refining in 1967. Mr. Galloway.
Lee Belkin, ladies and gentlemen. There'll probably be a slight credibility gap in this, being the production man who's total marine experience is a small boat to go bass fishing or a pea rope to go across the Louisiana swamps to a duck blind. But Mr. Haas, who, as Dean Belkin says, is our coordinator of the Manhattan Project, is on the Manhattan, and I'm happy to report it is on the high seas at the present time, heading for some ice. The SS Manhattan is at present endeavoring to collect the data required to establish a year-round commercial shipping route through the Northwest Passage. It is the purpose of this paper to outline in a general way the considerations and activities which led Humble Oil and Refining Company to the decision to conduct the test now underway. The preparation for the test and some of the potential impacts which could result should this new shipping route prove economically feasible. After Atlantic Richfield, Humble Oil Refining Company's joint discovery at Prudhoe Bay early last year, the problem of moving significant volumes of crude oil from the North Slope of Alaska to elsewhere in the United States began receiving increasing attention. On the basis of our projection of the needs of the United States economy and of the potential of the North Slope, it is our early conclusion that substantial portions of the crude oil from Prudhoe Bay Field and other hoped-for discoveries on the North Slope, and other hoped-for discoveries on the North Slope of Alaska would have to find a way to the eastern part of the United States. Could I have a light, please? Many routes and means of transportation have been considered, as shown on this slide. Much of the work was done together with Atlantic Richfield and BP Alaska Incorporated. Ordinary highways were discounted almost at once because terrain and high petroleum volumes made this uneconomical. Extension of the Alaska Railroad from Fairbanks to the North Slope could facilitate our material supply problems, but use of such a line for oil movement would be uneconomical also. To bring the oil to the southern shores of Alaska, a pipeline would be most economical. Tankers around the Horn of South America would consider it, but the cost here was almost prohibitive even with largest tankers. The Panama Canal was considered, but the present canal will only take 50,000 ton tankers. Again, this was not economical. A new sea level canal crossing the isthmus would be more interesting, but we could get no assurance when such a canal might be built. Even so, Panama represents a long, slow, 9,000 mile journey from Prudhoe to our eastern seaboard. We considered pipelines across Panama and Mexico and the southern United States, but eventually we narrowed the choice down to two basic alternates: a pipeline across North American continent. This pipeline route could be a direct across Canada, or alternately, first across Alaska, then ships to Washington, Oregon, and finally by pipeline to the East Coast. are to a marine solution by the use of large ice-breaking tankers from the north slope of Alaska to the east coast by way of the Northwest Passage. It is this latter case that we talk about today. The present voyage actually started just over a year ago. This was when the initial effort began to seek characteristics and cost for ships capable of Arctic transportation. We really knew only two initial facts. No regular commercial shipping had used the passage, but no large bulk cargo transportation needs had previously existed. Scientists, engineers, and government representatives familiar with ship operations and ice were consulted. Their answers to our questions supported and continue to support our belief that large, high-powered vessels could provide year-round Arctic service. Every question we asked, however, at least another was raised. Since cost estimates indicated a considerable transportation cost saving compared to alternate systems, we decided to answer the questions. For about 6 months through December 1968, work centered on further discussions, environmental documentation, ship ice performance investigation, and further economic analysis. We began two ship ice model test programs and two mass studies seeking power requirements for large ice-breaking ships. Transportation systems studied included single and convoy-type surface vessels, as well as submarines. Although all the studies continue to indicate probable feasibility for a surface vessel operation, the fact remained that no actual study validation currently exists. Last December, we decided to define the estimate accuracy by operating a large test vessel through the Northwest Passage. Slide 2 shows essentially the objectives of this test voyage are to establish vessel performance, the forces encountered, maneuverability in uniform and ridged ice. As previously mentioned, Atlantic Richfield and BP Alaska Incorporated have joined us during the preceding study period and share the data now being obtained while seeking these objectives. A suitable, heavily constructed, large, high-powered vessel, the SS Manhattan, was chartered by Humboldt and converted into an ice-breaking data acquisition system. The next slide shows several of the ship's modifications undertaken to convert Manhattan into an ice-breaking vessel. In addition to general hull strengthening, principal modifications are a new ice-breaking bow of the downbreaker type, an external sloping ice belt along the hull, stronger propellers and stale shafts. In view of the magnitude of the conversion work and the need for its completion as early as possible, it was decided to cut the ships into sections and employ the services of four separate shipyards. The next slide is a photograph showing the separation of the stern and midship sections. The next slide shows the Manhattan sectioned into five pieces. The basic contract for the conversion was with the Sun Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company in Chester, Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia. Sun retained the after section of the ship, about one half of the total, and did the conversion work at Chester. The midship section was towed to the Alabama Dry Dock and Shipbuilding Company yard in Mobile, Alabama, for conversion at this site. The next section, just forward of the midship section, was towed to the Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company at Newport News, West Virginia. The aft section of the new bow was built by Sun at the Chester Yard, and the forward section of the new bow was built at Bath Ironworks at Bath, Maine, and towed to Chester for installation. When the Manhattan was reassembled, her length had been increased from 940 feet to 1,005 feet, and her beam, or width at the broadest point, had been increased from 132 feet to 155 feet. The Manhattan became a commercial ship of superlatives, among other things, the longest and largest displacement in American flag service, the most extensively test instrumentation, the most powerful communication and advanced navigation gear. At one time, she was the longest ship in the world, stretching from Bath, Maine to Mobile, Alabama. The next slide shows an artist's conception of the way the Manhattan looks now. We feel that the efforts of our organization, working with technical consultants, scientists, professors, and government groups, has provided the best possible vehicle for data assimilation essential to future Arctic ship construction and operation. A good example of the cooperation began with the icebreaker operating experience which Humboldt ship officers have had. These include the U.S. Coast Guard Staten Island and the Canadian John A. McDonald. They also have worked with the Canadian and United States Ice Force Forecasting Observation Services. Additional pre-test ice data has been provided by work with the University of Alaska at Port Clarence. Canadian and United States ice physicists work on Parry Channel in the Bering Straits and off Point Barrow, and extensive Canadian and United States overflights through the Northwest Passage. Representatives of many of these organizations are now aboard the Manhattan. The commercial firms listed, in addition to ARCO and BP, are operating or maintaining the systems which they have developed and installed. Similar to NASA subcontractors, these men are flying their own hardware. Functionally, the vessel's component shown on this slide includes Humboldt's officers and crews, data analysts from the participating oil companies and affiliates, university and government ice experts, commercial contracted helicopter, instrument and communications personnel, and assorted members of the press, plus a ship surgeon not shown. Some of the test activities being undertaken are shown on this slide. In advance of the vessel, aircraft provided definitive reconnaissance with laser, infrared, and photographic gear, plus visual observation. This permits advanced planning of test conditions and data systems configuration. During the following test periods, ice physicists and analysts interpret and correlate the data being collected. As many as 8 video and magnetic recorders, several 700 millimeter film records, and 5 strip chart recorders are operating for normal test periods. During the test voyage, some data are being transmitted on dedicated facilities to Houston for further analysis. Concurrent with Arctic tanker test activities, work has been proceeding on North Slope marine terminal concepts. One highly interesting observation, a series of observations has been made on ice island fragments off Prudhoe Bay, shown on this slide. These have provided valuable information about ice flow around grounded structures and ambient environmental conditions on the fringe of North Slope, Alaska landfast ice. A second investigation utilizing natural harbor facilities pursued off the western Mackenzie Delta behind Herschel Island. This natural deep water seems attractive for harbor facilities, but is located about 200 miles east of Prudhoe Bay Area. I have a few slides taken last February showing ice conditions around Alaska. I think these are descriptive of the ice conditions which a ship might see when operating on a year-round basis. This slide is the ice in the Beaufort Sea showing the ridges which must be overcome by the vessel. This slide is a view off Wainwright about 1 mile offshore, and this last slide shows an open water lead in the background about 5 to 10 miles wide off of Point Barrow. It was there last February through May. It was there from February through May and demonstrates rather dramatically the value of having good reconnaissance and ice routing ahead of the ship. May I have the lights, please? The Northwest Passage Project is a promising, while difficult project, perhaps the most interesting that American industry has undertaken. Whether the route becomes a highway to market for Alaska oil, we think that the project's efforts has far-reaching effects, and that they may not presently be fully recognized. One basis for which we are proceeding is that petroleum will move from Alaska to a major United States East Coast market via the passage. That is, the current test will show the route's economy and feasibility. The United States shipbuilding industry would also immediately become a beneficiary of present more than $300 million venture. Projections show that about 250,000 deadweight ton tank vessels would be required for total industry U.S. coastwise transportation within the next 10 years. This represents a United States tanker fleet of about 2.5 times its present size. The total investment associated with the activity could approach $1.5 billion. Broader implications of the Northwest Passage Project conclusions of feasible Arctic marine transportation concern America's international relations. This would not only have an impact on our self-sufficiency in oil, but would give us export capability in a full emergency. Not only will a feasible Northwest Passage open a major sea route, but it also may bring other bulk commodities from the north to the market. This could spur Arctic development and influence significantly world trade patterns. A point on northern Banks Island is about equal distance from New York, London, Tokyo, and Murmansk. Coupled with the undeveloped mineral resources of the United States and the Canadian North, a feasible low-cost bulk trade route could materially affect the cost of supplying temperate zone products to our northern regions and generate many marine-related business activities which do not presently exist. The business, governmental, and university communities will be encountered with great difficulties and opportunities. The material gathered at this conference present a significant group of us concerned with the North. Anticipating future marine operations in the Northwest Passage, you should be giving thorough economic and policy studies, resolving questions in international trade, and further developing the present Arctic scientific knowledge.